Hello and welcome to The Life Scientific, coming to you complete with audience from the Royal Astronomical Society headquarters at London's Burlington House. Now, this is a place that holds special importance for my guest today, who first became a member of the RAS as an eager young student of physics back in the 1970s, and is now just coming to the end of his two-year term as the Society's president. Mike Edmonds is an emeritus professor of astrophysics at Cardiff University, where he's worked for some 50 years. And although physics is his first love, Mike is fascinated by an array of disciplines, from statistics to amateur dramatics to history. Wide-ranging interests that once prompted a PhD supervisor to describe him, slightly tongue-in-cheek, as a dilettante. But dabblers seldom enjoy such success. Mike's achievements range from interpreting the spread of chemical elements in the universe to decoding the world's oldest known astronomical artifact to performing his one-man play about Sir Isaac Newton. More about that shortly. Mike says he's taken great satisfaction in a career that's allowed him to think about the cosmos and our place in it, a calling which, of course, continues to this day. He says, like many of us, I continue to try and understand the story of the universe and how humankind has managed to discover the wider picture from our position on this speck of a planet orbiting the sun. Words that rather neatly point out our capacity for both accomplishment and insignificance. Professor Mike Edmonds, welcome to The Life Scientific.
Thank you, Jim.
Now, then, Mike, you're clearly a man of many talents, but much of your research has focused on the chemical abundances of stars. Can you just set out for us exactly what they are and why they're so important?
Well, when the universe started, essentially all that came out of the Big Bang in chemical terms was hydrogen, helium, and a tiny little bit of lithium. And all the chemical elements that are in the universe have formed since that time in various processes, in normal stars, in supernova explosions of stars, some possibly in the merger of neutron stars. And understanding those processes and how they've changed through time, how galaxies have built up the chemical elements they've got, is an interesting story and tells us a lot, too, about the evolution of the universe. So it's putting together that big jigsaw puzzle that I was interested in.
Now, obviously, there's a lot of important scientific ground that we're going to have to cover, but I did just mention your one-man play, Sir Isaac Remembers, and I think we do need to address this first. Am I right in saying this is a performance compiled entirely from Newton's own writing?
Essentially, plus a little bit of contemporary material and the old ad lib.
And, well, I'm going to put you on the spot here. I do wonder if you might give us a little taster.
Eh? Ah, well, yeah. My Principia Mathematica, year 1687. Now, Mr. Halley told me that he thought it was my divine treatise. Nearer the gods, no mortal man may approach. I thought all hours lost, not spent in study. But I remember a student passed me in the street and he said to his companion, there goes the man that writ a book that neither he nor anyone else can understand. I do not know what I may seem to the world, but to myself I seem to have only been like a boy playing on the seashore and diverting myself now and then in finding a smoother pebble or a prettier shell than ordinary, while the great ocean of truth lay all undiscovered before me.
Wonderful stuff. Well, it's almost as though Isaac Newton's here with us in the room. Well, Mike Edmonds, let's go back to the start of your story. You were born in 1949 in Dewsbury, Yorkshire, and that was one of several places your parents lived when you were young, because your father's job was in the railways.
He was. He'd been in the war. He'd been in the Royal Signals in the war. Having started, in fact, just before the war, going up to university and reading English, after the war, he went back to, I think, his first boyhood love of trains, of railways. And he became what I believe is called a traffic apprentice and had to sort of go round and get jobs in various places to learn the ropes, as it were, before he then came eventually the fat controller, basically. So it was, and I think my own interest in trains, because I do love old steam trains and models of them too, comes from those years, because when I was young, he used to sometimes take me out with him when he went to sort of see train wrecks up in the snow on the fells and things, and it's very difficult not to get a sort of romantic view of trains from that time.
You say he served in the war, World War II, of course. I gather his own father lost his life in the First World War.
Indeed, my grandfather, alas, died before he even knew his wife was pregnant. So he never knew, my grandfather, that he had a long line coming from him, which is great shame.
Well, your father's job, of course, meant a lot of moving around the country for you until you were 12, when he got a permanent position in Woking, in Surrey. And you started at the local grammar school there. You ended up taking A-levels in physics, chemistry, pure maths, applied maths, which earned you a place in Cambridge to read natural sciences. And the course kept you very busy.
Yeah, I should have done English or history or something. Science, natural sciences in those days is legendary. The first year, you were doing 3 degrees, basically. So it was very, very hard work. But it was very exciting, because I started doing subjects which I'd never done before. For example, there was a course on the biology of cells. That was very, very interesting, but an awful lot of work.
Well, it paid off. You graduated with a degree in physics in the summer of 1971 and knew you wanted to go into research as a career, but you weren't quite sure where or what that might be.
No, I had a little look round. There are various universities obviously doing astronomy. I even went to Oxford to find out a bit about meteorology. I thought that might be an interesting one to do. The studentship they offered me, though, involved, they said, we want to know a lot more about the electric fields in thunderstorms. Fine, electromagnetism. What we're going to do is we're going to teach you to fly, and we're going to have a glider with the equipment on that you will build, and then you will fly the glider up into the thunderstorm to measure the electric fields. I decided astronomy might be safer.
So, instead, you ended up doing a PhD at the Cambridge Observatory, involving a spectroscopic study of the light from stars. Maybe you can explain what that involves.
Well, we mentioned about chemical elements earlier. So how do you derive the abundance of chemical elements in stars? Well, the obvious way is through spectroscopy, splitting up the light, looking for the particular spectral lines that have a strength that's related to how much abundance there is in the stars. So basically, I spent most of the PhD using the 36-inch telescope in Cambridge then. I think I had one observing of 10 continuous 14-hour nights in an unheated dome, and I managed to get an ex-RAF Arctic suit, which I wore, and then analysing those results with computers and so on.
I think it's an important point to make here about the science. As you say, to try and understand what stars are made of, you're not travelling to the star. All we can do is capture light, and it's the light that tells us everything about the composition of the universe.
The analysis, you say, you observe the spectrum, and then you have a lot of analytics to do, making computer models of the stellar atmospheres, the transfer of radiation through the atmospheres and what you expect to see, altering in your computer program how much abundance of nickel or whatever it is you put in until you can match the spectrum, and then try and get relative abundances of elements in different stars, and then relating the different kinds of stars and their different properties to see what you can learn about how the nuclear synthesis has taken place and what that's telling you about how star formation has progressed in galaxies, etc.
Well, that research at Cambridge came to an end with perfect timing, because the University College of Wales in Cardiff, now Cardiff University, was just moving into astronomy. You applied, you secured a research fellowship, which would then end up becoming a permanent lectureship, and you moved to Wales. It was a busy first few years. Not only were you teaching, you were embarking on new research, and it was around this time, mid-70s, that you embarked on a working relationship that would span decades with the esteemed astrophysicist Bernard Pagel of Sussex University and the Royal Greenwich Observatory. And your first joint project involved looking at the light coming from glowing gas regions in the Magellanic Clouds, the two dwarf galaxies near to our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, before we go any further, can you tell us a bit more about those spectra and why they're so important?
Well, stars are not necessarily very bright. There are some very bright stars, but most of them not that bright compared with some other things in the universe. And if you want to analyse the chemical composition in galaxies near our own, and nowadays way away from our own, you really need something that's a little bit brighter than stars, although modern methods are helping that in nearby galaxies. So one of the things you can look at is regions of interstellar gas heated by young hot stars, because the gas itself then emits spectral lines, not the stars, the actual gas emits spectral lines.
It's hot enough to glow.
Indeed, basically. And they can give very strong lines from the glowing gas region, and then you can analyse them again to get chemical compositions. Again, you have to make assumptions about the physical conditions and so on, but you can then begin to get information. And this programme started just when the Anglo-Australian telescope, which was the first really decent telescope that the UK had access to, a 3.9-metre telescope in Australia, came into use. And it was a wonderful opportunity to be able to observe these external galaxies, first the Magellanic Clouds, and then starting doing spiral galaxies and developing methods to do that. And I have to say, we did develop some methods of that that are still actually used today. So it was quite a successful program.
Of course, between trips to Australia, you were back in Cardiff. And it was around this time that your one-man play came into being. Tell me how it came about.
Well, it's one of those things. The student society, the physics society, heard I had an interest in Newton. I'd been reading some books, and I must have made some remark in lectures about this. Said, well, could you give a talk about Isaac Newton? I thought, well, talk would be a bit sort of dusty. So I thought, well, maybe I could do it as a sort of dramatic thing. And I had actually been looking at some of his letters. There's a big stack of his books, of his letters in the library. So I prepared a sort of one-man show, about an hour, trying to sort of give it the idea of what he was like based on his letters. And he's a very interesting character. Not perhaps the nicest of men, but extremely interesting. And so that's how it started. And once I'd done it once, then I gradually began to give it to other places, other astronomical societies, other science societies, a couple of times in the United States and so on. But it's only a couple of times a year.
Wonderful. Well, back to the science, Mike. In 1987, you became involved with efforts trying to convince the UK to build a world-leading telescope here.
Indeed. I'd become, over the years, a member of many committees and working groups that looked at the observational facilities that the UK had. And by that time, it became obvious that we were going to be left out the big league unless we made a push to get bigger facilities. And in particular with Professor Richard Ellis, he was only a humble doctor then, at Durham University, we got together and informally and sort of said, well, look, we need to do something about this. And we wrote an informal report. It was sort of accepted, and what was set up then was called the Large Telescope Panel, which then worked for a couple of years trying to work out the best way for the UK to enter into a large telescope programme. And that was successful. It resulted in the Gemini telescopes and eventually us joining the European Southern Observatory. Mm. So it was a transitionary time that led to making sure that the UK did have large observational facilities in the optical infrared.
And are we still doing well in astronomy? I mean, what's the state of UK astronomy sector today?
Well, I rate it as good. More money would be a very good thing, as ever. But we're still involved in very good projects. The European Southern Observatory is marvellous. It's heading towards what will be the biggest telescope in the world, the extremely large telescope, as they call it.
They're very imaginative names, aren't they?
Also, the UK is working with the Square Kilometre Array, which is a radio astronomy project that will come to fruition within the next few years. So I think we're doing very well, but we can't be complacent.
The Government's Science, Innovation and Technology Committee held an inquiry into astronomy last year where you gave evidence, and you pointed out a major worry for professional astronomy. If there are too many satellites in orbit around the Earth, they're going to interfere inevitably with astronomical observations, aren't they?
Indeed, and people are now launching clusters of satellites, not just a single satellite, but maybe 1,000 satellites at a time in order to provide global coverage for this or that. Now, there are things that can be done. You can make sure that your satellites are dull, dark, and not reflecting light as best you can. That really needs international legislation to enforce that. So that's one thing you can do for optical telescopes. It's maybe even more of a worry for radio telescopes, though, because all of these satellites have to have telemetry back to the Earth and so on. And it's all right if they work well and stick to the frequency that's supposed to be broadcasting on. But if something goes wrong and it's not broadcasting on the correct frequency or whatever, that can completely ruin an astronomical observation. So there's got to be international legislation that will minimise the effect on observations.
Well, Mike, back to Cardiff, where in 1997 you embarked on a new research project with some colleagues, particularly Steve Eales and then research student Hayley Gomez, a former guest, in fact, on the Life Scientific herself. This project spanned about a decade and was all about the origin of interstellar dust. Just remind me what you showed and how.
Well, interstellar dust, it's an interesting thing, but some people it's an absolute nuisance because it gets in the way of the light coming through. For other people it's wonderful because it radiates and they can observe the radiation in distant galaxies from it. The problem was, where does it come from? And there had been many ideas. The sort of best buy at that time was it was produced in the atmospheres of giant stars late in their evolution. But I just did a little tiny bit of modelling, very simple bit of modelling, which is if you're going to make dust, you need the elements to make dust. So have a look at the elements being made, which we talked about earlier. When do you get enough elements to make the dust? Because you have to make the elements, then put them in the stars where the dust is made, and wait till the dust is made. And for early galaxies, there just isn't time to do that cycle. So the obvious thing is, well, maybe it's put into dust where the elements are made. Perhaps in the supernova that go off, that's where you make the dust as well as the elements. Now, it was rather an idea that was poo-pooed because it was thought the supernova explosion itself would destroy any dust it made. But, you know, maybe it doesn't. And we looked at that possibility. And over time, I think people have come to accept that, yes, supernova are a viable source of dust. There are observations now that do look at supernova and do detect large quantities of dust. So it looks as though it is a viable mechanism for making dust.
Clearly discovering the origins of interstellar dust hadn't given you enough to be getting on with, because a couple of years later, you embarked on another rather different long-term project involving the Antikythera mechanism. It's an ancient Greek, almost clock-like device for astronomical calculations, dating back to 100 BC, something like that.
150 BC, yeah.
I mean, it sounds like something from a movie.
It is in a movie.
It is, isn't it? Listeners might recognise it as the inspiration for the fictional Dial of Destiny, a recent Indiana Jones movie. OK, Mike, tell me about the real thing.
It's an artefact. It was found in a shipwreck around 1900, and it was brought to the National Archaeological Museum in Athens. Nobody realised what it was to begin with. It's just a lump of bronze. However, somebody noticed there were gear wheels in there, and subsequently inscriptions were noticed on the thing that made clear that it had some astronomical purpose. But it wasn't really until the 1960s, when radiography came to be used on it, that it was realised how complicated this thing was. It undoubtedly had at least 30 gear wheels in it that exist, and if when it was working, it would probably have at least 35, maybe many more if it was a more complicated version. Now, a student came to me and said he wanted a fairly practical project to look at, and I just happened to see a picture of this device in a textbook in engineering history. I said, well, look, let's see what it is. And we spent the year finding out everything that was known about this device, and in fact got far enough to write a paper at the end of it. He did very well in his degree, and I got this review paper about this strange device, you know, a calculator, mechanical calculator from 100 BC. Right, I thought, television program.
So obviously.
I contacted a friend of the family's who was a filmmaker, and he got very interested in this. And we started going around trying to sell the idea. But wherever we went, they said, ah, yes, but what's new? Well, no, it's...
That's the whole point.
It's not new. No, but what's recently been discovered? And it then dawned that, you know, yeah, that's fair enough. What is new about the research on this? And if we're going to really understand this device, we're going to have to do our own new research. And that's exactly what happened. Over a period of 4 years, we set up together a international research program called the Antikythera Mechanism Research Project, which involved scientists from Greece, America, and ourselves, also epigraphers, historians of science, even numinists, a whole lot of disciplines. We managed to borrow a X-ray machine to do X-ray tomography, in other words, like a body scan. Weighs about 9 tons. We had to take it down to Athens on the back of a lorry.
You had to get permission from the Greek government
for
this?
Yeah, that only took 4 years.
Oh, okay.
And we'd have never done it without our Greek collaborators. So we gave it a body scan, we did some surface imaging, and remarkably, after about a year or so, we'd cracked how the thing worked. And we had a Nature paper, big Nature paper, and a conference at the same time in Athens. And it made headlines. Only media storm I've ever been involved in. My wife dines out on the story that we're in my hotel room, and she answers the phone, and she said, "Yes, the New York Times? No, I'm afraid he's on the other line to the Washington Post."
You know you've made it when they come calling.
But anyway, the research continued in various ways for some years after that, with more sophisticated analysis of what we'd found. And it was remarkable. The most wonderful thing about this device is a calendrical device in a lot of ways. It shows where the sun is in the sky, where the moon is in the sky. It does very subtle modelling of the motion of the moon, displays cycles of the month and new moons and so on, and also when eclipses are liable to occur. So it's quite a complicated device. And as we went on and researched this more and more, what became apparent is it fits perfectly into the astronomy of its time and into the technology of its time. But until we did that work, a lot of people just thought it must be a fake, or it's just, you know...
Or built by aliens, maybe.
That's also possible. But, well, no. But that was good. It did fit so beautifully into the time. The only thing it wasn't very good at is predicting where the moon was in the sky. But maybe that didn't matter. It was probably maybe a display device, a teaching device, or my favourite one is that it's actually something a rich man buys to put on his mantelpiece to show their great interest in astronomy.
You mentioned teaching there, Mike. You took early retirement from Cardiff University in 2007, mainly I hear to be free from all the admin, which is totally understandable. But of course, you've continued to teach yourself. You're also the current president here at the Royal Astronomical Society. You were elected in 2022. That must have been a big honour.
Indeed it was. As I say, I've been a fellow for many, many years, but never imagined I'd be running the meetings and being the president. And it's been a great privilege. I have to say it's been a lot more work than I expected, but that's probably good. And it's been a very interesting 2 years, culminating this year in the wonderful thing. The courtyard here has five societies around it: the Royal Society of Chemistry, the Linnaeans, the Geological Society, the Society of Antiquaries, and ourselves. And for years we've had uncertainty about the lease on this building and whether we'd be allowed to stay. This year we've managed to come to an agreement, the societies together with the government, to purchase a 999-year lease on the property. So one thing that will have come out of my presidency is not to do with me, it's all the people who've done all the hard work in the past, but it really means that this place now has a 1,000-year history in this building to go forward, doing science, communicating science, and that's a wonderful thing.
Time maybe to turn to questions from our audience here at the Royal Astronomical Society. Immediately a hand has gone up enthusiastically there.
If the shipwreck that caused the Antikythera mechanism to go missing had not occurred, do you think it would have revolutionised and helped advance modern science and technology?
Now, that's a lovely question, because it's almost inverse, because we only know about the Antikythera mechanism because it was in that shipwreck. If it hadn't been in that shipwreck, it would not have survived. We know of no other example that survives of it, because there was a huge bronze recycling industry around the classic world. Bronze was expensive, so you always recycled it. So nothing would have survived had it not been for the shipwreck. So in a way, it was good that it shipwrecked. But the question, however, does presume something else, which is, well, why did that technology get lost? Because it did get lost. And that's unclear. Whether it had to do with possibly the adoption of religious views later, around 500 AD, that somehow assumed that this was perhaps connected with astrology and was evil or something that might have suppressed it, I don't know. The technology might have gone into the Arabic world and might have survived a bit there, but we don't know, although there's still a lot of work I think could be done there. So I think it would have been interesting had that tradition been much more live by the time you got to 1200, 1300, 1400.
Hi, Mike. I wanted to ask about what you think about the next 50 years of astronomy. We're, fingers crossed, hopefully getting data from Vera Rubin soon, from Euclid, even thinking about the integration of artificial intelligence in astronomy now. What are you most excited about for the next phase of astronomy?
Well, I think what must be surely going to be the most exciting thing is the development of the study of exoplanets and their atmospheres and whether there are signs of life.
These are planets beyond our solar system.
Yeah, around other stars. Around which, again, when I was a research student, you know, they say, you know, are there planets around other stars? Dunno. Dunno. But we do know now. We know that almost every star has a planetary system, and that's, you know, a fantastic thing to investigate. The other thing, of course, we'd like to know about is dark matter. And in a way, there's a rather a nice parallel, because I don't believe we have any idea, really, what dark matter is. There are good reasons for thinking it's there, but we've really no idea what it is, how it behaves, really. And there's a parallel here with my old Antikythera mechanism and the Greeks, because the Greeks were in a position then to predict planetary orbits extremely accurately, right? And we can do that too. We just assume dark matter and put the term in the equation, we can do evolution of the universe quite well. But the Greeks had no idea why they had the orbits until Newton was there and put the gravitation in. Similarly, we need something new to be able to understand this dark matter and how that affects the universe. I'm only hoping it doesn't take another millennium until that happens.
Well, that's all we have time for, unfortunately. Huge thanks to our wonderful audience here at London's Royal Astronomical Society. And, of course, to today's guest, Mike Edmonds, thank you very much for sharing your life scientific.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a pleasure.